Oh, so that's what Farfugnugan means. Huh. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 21st of September. Great to have you here, as always, everybody. All right, so Farfugnugan technically translates as driving enjoyment, not doctoring emissions equipment to cheat on EPA pollution standards. But you get my drift. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, says Volkswagen did exactly that. Bloomberg reports today that the Justice Department has started a criminal investigation. And consumers, well, they're the $64,000 question, right? Volkswagen is looking at billions of dollars in potential fines and penalties. But the biggest cost may be the loss of consumer trust, because fines they can pay. But trust, what are they going to do about that? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
PR people will tell you when a company makes a mistake, the best thing to do is admit it quickly and immediately try and make right by consumers. Business school students literally study how well Tylenol did this during a recall in the 1980s.
Well, this is a little different kind of thing.
David Cole is the chairman of Auto Harvest and a longtime industry analyst. He says this isn't a safety issue like past recalls, and it doesn't appear to be a mistake.
This idea of trust as something gone on in the back room that has really tarnished the image of the vehicles and the company.
He says there are a lot of good cars on the market these days, so potential buyers could very easily pivot to another automaker. How much this affects resale value or sales of new Volkswagens will depend on what it takes to fix the issue and whether it hurts the car's performance, says Greg Schroeder. He's with the Center for Automotive Research.
They've marketed themselves as a clean diesel, and this is certainly a challenge to that.
In the past, when Ford, Hyundai, and Kia were found to have overly, shall we say, optimistic gas mileage estimates, they cut checks to drivers to try and make up the difference. Jack Nerad with Kelley Blue Book says VW might have to try something similar. But he thinks VW's recovery might be complicated by the fact that its customers, especially its diesel owners, tend to be really nerdy about their cars, passionate.
And I think those people could feel essentially duped by what has happened and kind of question their loyalty going forward.
The more loyal the customer, the more betrayed they may feel.
Yeah, I mean, if a stranger lies to you, it's a lot different than if your husband or wife lies to you.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The company that really put crowdfunding on the map, Kickstarter, is making some news, not for a project being funded on the site, but about the company itself. It has reincorporated as what is known as a B Corp, a public benefit corporation, which means it is required to consider its impact on society as part of the business that it does. Marketplace's Adrian Hill looks at doing well while doing good.
Next time you contribute to some amazing innovation on Kickstarter, maybe like this one.
Sculpted in three dimensions and poured by hand in London, this is the queen of all lollipops.
You'll be supporting Queen Elizabeth II shaped chocolate lollies and the social good. Kickstarter has reincorporated as a public benefit corporation. And when you go that route, says Georgetown law professor Alicia Plurhopoulos,
you are affirmatively changing your fiduciary duties
to put other factors ahead of profit for investors.
Now we also are obligated to consider other stakeholders,
like the environment, society, employees. So far, only a very small number of companies have incorporated this way. So why Kickstarter?
This is a moment where we're putting our cards on the table.
That's CEO and co-founder Yancey Strickler.
We're saying exactly who we are, exactly what it means to do business with Kickstarter.
The company is committing to reducing its environmental impact. It won't use tax loopholes, and it'll give a percentage of its profits to organizations that support the arts and social justice. Helen Bowers is a finance professor at the University of Delaware.
If you have this equal obligation to some other public benefit, then, you know, there will be times relative to the same company where the shareholder will not get that benefit.
But Bauer says what's less clear is if that will actually deter investors. Yancey Strickler doesn't think so. He says Kickstarter has been a profitable private company for 5 years.
I think that, you know, for people who want to see a similar sort of change in the world, who want to see more companies act in this way, I believe they'll be drawn to us.
And as for whether projects on Kickstarter will have to play by the same do-gooder rules, nope. The lollipop company can just focus on making queen-shaped lollipops, if that's what it wants to do. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
A correction before we move on. We said in a segment on product placement a couple of weeks ago that Bloomberg had paid to have its terminals featured on the HBO show The Newsroom. That's not so. We had it wrong. On Wall Street today, it was a little bit herky-jerky. Not too bad, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Berlin over the weekend talking to his European counterparts about the migrant crisis that continues to grow over there by the day. Kerry said the United States is going to accept 85,000 migrants next year, up to 100,000 in 2017. That's a big increase. There is no small amount of budgeting that's going to happen to get all those people here. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer breaks down all the resettlement line items.
The resettlement process starts even before the refugee sets foot in the U.S. with a checkup.
For example, TB is checked for.
That's Leonard Doyle. He's spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, a nonprofit known as an intergovernmental organization that helps resettle refugees. He says once the health check is done, refugees get a little cultural orientation. They're told life in the U.S. may not be quite what you've imagined.
You may have seen a lot about it in the movies, but it's not quite like that.
One refugee organization, Church World Service, even has a model of a U.S. home. Spokesman Will Haney says a lot of attention is paid to the bathroom and kitchen.
They can play with a stove as to see about the knobs, microwaves. We have sample airline seats as well so that people can practice what it's like to be in an airline seat.
The U.S. government gives these groups a lump sum to cover those health screenings and the cultural orientation. It isn't divided up per refugee and varies from group to group. It's different once a refugee arrives in the U.S. The State Department gives nonprofits almost $2,000 per refugee for expenses. Some of that goes toward administrative overhead, but most of the money goes to the refugee for things like food and apartment, furniture and clothes.
And all of this has to be covered for at least a month and sometimes more, usually more.
Lavinia Limon is president and CEO of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. She says if the State Department money runs out before the refugees find a job, the nonprofit turns to the community, churches, and former refugees. The goal is to get the refugees settled in with a job in 3 to 6 months. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
To keep on going with this idea of where refugees and migrants go when they get here, the truth is we don't know exactly where they're going to be headed, but we do know one thing. It's not going to be Wyoming. That's the only state without a resettlement program. From Wyoming Public Radio, Caroline Ballard explains.
Now, Wyoming does have residents who are former refugees, people like Bertine Bahij, who came from the Congo. Today, he lives in Gillette, a coal mining town. And he's a high school math teacher.
Coming, I'm coming.
After class, Bahij coaches cross country, tutors a homebound student, and then finally returns to his family. His wife was born here, and now they have two kids. He says these 12-hour days are an effort to give back to the state.
They gave me an opportunity to raise a family. And I work every day as hard as I can as an act of thankfulness. You know, and that can be any other refugee.
Bahij is an advocate for starting a refugee resettlement program in Wyoming. Resettlement programs help screen and sponsor refugees, then provide a stipend, orientation, and English classes for new arrivals. In 2013, Wyoming's Republican Governor Matt Mead looked at starting a refugee resettlement program. That did not go over well with everyone. Here's an opponent, Republican state legislator Scott Clem, also from Gillette.
We're the least populated state in the union. Just a small change in the demographics here could upset the Wyoming economy, the Wyoming culture.
He, along with other Republican legislators and citizen groups, don't like the idea of spending money to bring foreigners to the state's small communities. Wyoming's unemployment rate is lower than the national average, hovering around 4%. But people are still worried about jobs and government spending, especially with the recent downturn in the energy industry. Representative Clem again.
As it is with our decreasing revenues, we have to be careful of what we can do. We have to take care of Wyoming's own first.
Opposition stalled the governor's earlier efforts, but he's looking into resettlement again this year. He's tapped the Wyoming Humanities Council to put on public discussions where people can talk about refugees and a possible resettlement program. Shannon Smith is the council's executive director.
And, you know, I'm not saying one way or the other because we may all look at it and say we just don't have the capacity, but I think we have the heart.
Bahij, the math teacher from Gillette, first landed in Maryland. He didn't speak English and took a job as a fast food worker. Then he got a scholarship to the University of Wyoming. He points out Wyoming can't stop refugees from moving to the state once they're residents.
Refugees will make it to Wyoming. Either, you know, is first arriver or second arriver, somebody who, like me, was resettled somewhere else and made their way to Wyoming. That will happen.
The first discussion panels about what a resettlement program could look like in Wyoming will start later this fall. In Gillette, Wyoming, I'm Caroline Ballard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Detroit was a very big city. It's now becoming a smaller one. But in a way, it's an interesting extreme case of what you see in a lot of cities that are finding their way forward.
You know that voice. Our project with Jim Fallows, American Futures, is back via the Motor City. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 125 points today, 0.75%, closed at 16,510. The NASDAQ picked up a point, just a fraction of 1%. 48-28. The S&P 500 up 8 points, almost a half percent, ended things at 1966. Told you about VW's troubles with the EPA earlier in the broadcast. Volkswagen shares over in Germany off 17%. How's this for the intersection of politics and business? Hillary Clinton sent out a tweet this morning criticizing the privately held Turing Pharmaceuticals firm for buying up rights to an old drug, then raising the price 50-fold. She said, Clinton did, that she will be out with a plan tomorrow on what she calls price gouging. Investors did not wait that long to start dumping biotech shares. Immunogen Inc. down 16%. Biogen and Vertex Pharmaceuticals both off about 5%. Turing, by the way, returned the patent on that drug to the nonprofit late this afternoon, so the price is back down a bit. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.20%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Pope Francis has another day and a half or so left in his Cuba visit. He lands in Washington late tomorrow afternoon. Appearances begin on Wednesday. And by the time he leaves via Philadelphia Sunday night, millions of people will have seen him speak. And if his recent encyclical on the environment is any indication, they're going to get an earful about climate change and capitalism and the not always helpful role of the markets in this society. From our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has more.
Let's first get to this. There are some who consider the Pope's writings downright anti-capitalist. Steve Sakala teaches at the Academic Shrine to Laissez-Faire Capitalism, the econ department at the University of Chicago.
It's sort of too far beyond the pale to even be engaged by serious people.
We'll come back to that. But for starters, we go to the Pope's encyclical on the environment and his view of the cause of the climate problem. That's less controversial. He says the earth is increasingly an immense pile of filth and that polluters must pay their share.
Although he speaks his language, this is really the language of market failure.
Lord Nicholas Stern at the London School of Economics wrote a defining paper on climate change, which he calls the greatest market failure ever seen. Here's why. Carbon pollution hurts the environment, that's a cost, but the polluters in much of the world, they pay nothing.
If you, because it's costless, dump chemicals upstream from a brewery, you affect the ability of the brewery to do its work. And of course, with climate change, you're filling up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases and using essentially the atmosphere as a sewer into which you dump your stuff for nothing.
Stuff that traps heat, in many cases for centuries. Now, numbers guys like Stern estimate the impacts of more floods and less sea ice. They speak the arcane language of tons of CO2 emitted and dollars of damage per ton. The Pope, way more accessible.
He says that God always forgives, people sometimes forgive, and nature never forgives.
So, if a failed market caused the problem, can the market fix things? Now, the standard policy answer is yes. Complex trading markets that make it expensive to pollute are growing around the world. But the Vatican document says markets are not good to ration the burning of fossil fuels or the use of water, that the environment is defenseless against market forces. Environmental economist Brian Murray teaches at Duke.
This is where many economists who study environmental markets and carbon markets might take exception to the Pope.
And this is tricky for Murray, who is also Catholic. He says markets to limit carbon emission absolutely curb those emissions. But he says the Vatican soured on the idea a few years ago when it tried to use these markets to go carbon neutral.
They put up solar panels on the roof of buildings in the Vatican, not St. Peter's. And the other thing they did was to purchase these carbon offsets, and they did not materialize.
Here's what happened. The Vatican paid a company planting a new forest so those trees would absorb carbon dioxide and reduce the Vatican's footprint to zero. But the forest never happened. Carbon market fail. Now, the broader question is whether the Pope likes markets at all. Carolyn Wu says yes. She's CEO of Catholic Relief Services and a former business school dean. Now, in her view, the pontiff just believes in regulating the market, which is nothing new.
There are product standards, for example. There are rules regarding labor. There are taxes to be paid. So markets need some degree of regulation in order to make sure that we don't create situations where it eliminates swath of people.
Especially poor people, a big focus of the encyclical. In fact, many studies suggest climate change disproportionately hurts poor agrarian countries that rely on stable weather patterns.
It's one thing to say that when markets work, some people win, some people lose, and that's too bad. If you're weak, you don't need to survive. Well, that is not our conception of the human society.
As much as Wu defends the Pope, in fact, she joined him in Rome to release the encyclical, she wishes his writing were more nuanced on business and markets. Steve Sakala at the University of Chicago is less charitable.
He comes out as anti-air conditioning. He says the markets which immediately benefit from sales stimulate ever greater demand, as if there's some sort of market conspiracy to get people to buy air conditioners.
He says the document shows plainly the Pope's skepticism of a modern market economy. It's a polarized reaction to a man known for strong opinions. And the question is, how will he choose his words when he speaks in the U.S. starting Wednesday? In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There was a happy calendar coincidence while I was out in Detroit last week. Had a chance to catch up with Jim and Deb Fallows and renew the project that we've spent some time on the past couple of years, American Futures, it's called.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, we've got Tango for landing.
Destination is at Eastport Echo Papa Mike for 50.
Jim and Deb have been flying around the country in their own small plane, stopping in small towns and a couple of bigger cities, talking to people along the way, trying to figure out what America is today. I get to join them every now and then, getting a glimpse of the economy from up in their plane at 2,500 feet and then down on the ground as well. Anyway, they were in Detroit. I was in Detroit. We'd been looking for a way to catch up with each other, so it all worked out. I started this chat with Jim and Deb the way I usually start. Jim, it is good to see you again.
Kai, nice to see you here in Detroit.
Well, so let's start with Detroit, right? We've been here doing some stories. You've been here at a conference, and I want to talk about this city in the context of the American Futures Project. Frame that for me.
So most of the places that we've been visiting together and my wife Deb and I have been seeing have been smaller cities. Detroit was a very big city. It's now becoming a smaller one. But in a way, it's an interesting extreme case of what you see in a lot of cities that are finding their way forward. Detroit is extreme because of its size, because of its racial history, because of what's happened to the auto industry. And also, which I hadn't realized, is the unusual settlement pattern here. It is fascinating to me how the narrative has shifted to one we're hearing in a lot of other places too, which is finding ways ahead. The downtown, the restoration, the manufacturing startups and all the rest. So even Detroit is having this kind of let's find our way forward picture we've seen in a lot of other places.
So give me a couple of those other places that you've been over the past 6 months. Fresno, California comes to mind.
Fresno was fascinating to us in that Californians like to look down on Fresno. Yeah. And they're aware of that, and they've had some big problems, especially with the devastation of their downtown over the last 40 or 50 years by suburban sprawl. Even in Fresno, you have an ambitious liberal Republican mayor, Ashley Swearingen, who's worked with the businesses, worked with urban planners to try to attract tech companies back there. You have people in their 20s and 30s saying, we can't afford to have an art studio in Los Angeles, but in Fresno, because rent is so cheap, we can have our bohemian center and all the rest. So Fresno, I think, is very much on an upslope. It even has craft breweries downtown, the mark of greatness.
So it's only 4 hours from L.A., so I can get in the car. You have been a lot of time in the Pacific Northwest and also sort of northern Great Plains.
Yes, we saw a fascinating place, the American Prairie Reserve in north-central Montana. It's a huge place, the same scale as the Serengeti in Africa. Their ambition is, like the Serengeti, to restore it to the original, the pre-Lewis and Clark flora and fauna, the fauna including bison and elk and everything else, and to do that in sort of a market-savvy way, where they're paying ranchers to raise their cattle in a way that will permit the bison to come in and the wolves and all the rest and the grizzly bears. And it's a fascinating place with a long-term 15 or 20-year vision, the ways they're trying to combine technology and lots of other things to have their aviation, too, to have their rebirth.
I want to turn the tables a little bit, and I want you to change seats with your wife.
Yes, good.
Because she sometimes, is better than
usually,
you.
Usually,
I'm just saying. Deb Fallows, linguist by training. Observer of human nature, I think, is the way you have been cast in this voyage that you and Jim are on, right?
Okay. Also, riding shotgun in the plane?
In the plane. What has struck you the past 6 months? I mean, Jim and I were talking earlier over email. You guys have been on the road basically half of your time. So what has hit you?
This is true. I think one of the biggest surprises for me is how one of the oldest institutions in the country is on a huge and important comeback, and that's public libraries. They know what's going on in towns. They know what the needs are. They know what the gaps are. They know what the shortfalls are. It's just been astonishing to me how they have, place by place, stepped up and filled in.
Do you think these libraries feel supported by, not the community, right, because the community are their customers, but by local governments and the people who can get them the money they need to do this?
Yeah,
job?
It's interesting because it really varies place by place. Sometimes they have the support. Sometimes they do it through philanthropy. And curiously, in a number of these towns, even though the towns are suffering terribly and have had huge cutbacks in a lot of funding, people are voting bond issues to keep their libraries going. So somehow the word is getting out there that we love our library, we need our library, and we're going to support it even if we can't support anything else. So that is a really heartening thing as well.
Deborah Fallows, Jim Fallows over there taking pictures. Say goodbye, Jim.
Hi, Kai. Nice to see you.
Great to see you, Kai.
All right,
thanks.
You guys. Be good.
Thanks.
Lots of background noise in that one. You just got to go with it. We call it ambient radio. You can follow along in the continuing adventures of Jim and Deb Fallows and our project, American Futures, at our website. It's marketplace.org. And if you think there's a place we ought to go next, tell us. Final note on the way out today, a social network that promises to be way more fun than Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn or any of them will ever be. The rapper Snoop Dogg announced at a tech conference today that he is starting a social network based around cannabis. It's going to be called Mary Jane. It's in beta testing now. Only 420 people will be allowed in at first. 420, get it? 420. Anyway, Snoop says he uses pot medicinally and also because it's a peace thing for him. So, you know, he knows his customer base. That's a plus. The Dow up 125 points, 0.75%. Today, the NASDAQ up a point, just a fraction percentage-wise. The S&P 500 up 8 points, almost a half percent. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.